You're listening to a download from North Sound One. Listen again.
Hello and welcome to the Energy Week podcast. I'm Joe Odber. Oil bosses have been raising last-minute concerns about plans to cut staff at Aberdeen's Coast Guard Service. Oil and Gas UK say they're not convinced the reduced team could deal with a North Sea disaster. A public consultation on the Westminster cuts comes to an end in a matter of days. Bob Lauder is Oil and Gas UK's Health and Safety Manager. Rebecca Curran caught up with him on Friday to talk about oil workers' worries.
Our main concern are around the proposed reductions in staffing levels, particularly the staffing levels in the Aberdeen Rescue Coordination Centre.
Now, how do you think that the reduction in staff is going to impact on, say, you know, a major disaster offshore?
Well, our view on that is that the current arrangements are tried and tested. They've been in place for quite some time. They're well practiced. They're well proven. So we believe that the current staffing level is adequate, fits the bill. And any reduction in that, we believe, can only diminish the capability of the Rescue Coordination Centre and their ability to support our industry.
If you want to speak about the tugboats for a second, I mean, can you explain to us what exactly they are used for?
The tugboats, or emergency towing vessels as they're referred to, they were put in place after the Breyer incident on Shetland some time ago. The Donaldson Inquiry recommended that there was tugboats in place to remove tankers from that had gone aground and were causing spills to sea and then to land. So they have served that purpose over time. So they're there for both the environmental and, in fact, the safety impact. So they do provide they're a link in the chain, if you like, in the overall emergency response chain for the oil and gas industry.
So how concerned are you that, you know, two of them are gone?
We have some concern because our member companies who operate the shore-based facilities, the processing terminals, they do rely on those emergency towing vessels for the shipping that transits in and out of their facilities.
Now, I wonder if we can put it in perspective. I mean, the Coast Guard Centre in Aberdeen, I mean, how integral were they for, say, you know, tragedies like the one that happened on the 1st of April 2009?
Absolutely central to that. You really can't overstate the part that the Coast Guard play in an incident like that. They become the real hub of the coordinated response effort. If you can imagine, an incident like that is very complex in nature. There's a lot of communication channels need to be maintained. There's many facilities and assets that need to be coordinated, and that's where the Coast Guard come into their own. That's their speciality, and that's the level of support that they provide to our industry.
And I mean, how much more difficult would it have been dealing with somebody that, you know, wasn't actually here in Aberdeen?
Significantly more different in actual fact. If you set aside, and we shouldn't set aside, the local knowledge and the competence built up over many years of working together with the Aberdeen Coast Guard, the industry working with the Aberdeen Coast Guard, the reality is that they've shown themselves to be absolutely the right people to deal with our industry over time, and we would regard any kind of move away from that as being some kind of problem that we would have to deal with.
Now, tell us what you're going to be, you know, doing with these concerns. I mean, obviously, okay, There's a consultation ongoing at the moment.
Sure. Yeah, we're in what's essentially a second phase of consultation. So there's some revised proposals came out from the MCA. They close next week on the 6th of October, and we'll be voicing our concern in the form of a submission to parts other than Aberdeen affected by these proposals or something.
Is there anywhere else other than Aberdeen that's going to be affected by this?
Yeah, there is indeed. Our membership extends south of the border and in the east side of the country on the southern North Sea. The proposals show that Great Yarmouth will close. And then over on the other side of the country, and the East Irish Sea, Morecambe Bay, Liverpool Bay area, Liverpool is scheduled to close as a result of the latest proposals. Both of those are very much in the same style as Aberdeen, in actual fact, many years of working relationship with local Coast Guard and industry. And we see both of those closures as being an issue for the oil companies operating in those areas.
So, you know, say if something, you know, did happen offshore, if there was some sort of a disaster, you know, where would you be drawing extra expertise from if you know, there's a lack of staff in Aberdeen?
The proposals show that all of the retained stations post the closures will have resilience, will talk to each other, will be able to support each other. And we support that. We have no problem with that kind of level of redundancy and level of interaction. But what it does require is a significant upskilling, if you like, in relation to the people who are taking on oil business that didn't previously do it. So we do believe there's going to be some transitional difficulties, if you like, until everybody attains the same level of knowledge and competence that Aberdeen currently has. And in fact, Liverpool and Great Yarmouth to that extent. Yeah.
So the staff that are remaining, you know, definitely an increased pressure on them.
We have to believe that, yeah. We're talking about significant numbers in actual fact, going from 31 down to 23 in Aberdeen. And that's a quite a sizeable reduction, makes a difference to the number of people on shift at any time, and really would, we believe, add to their workload and perhaps make life more difficult during an emergency.
Bob Lauder from Oil and Gas UK there. Now, families of the men killed in the North Sea helicopter crash should receive their compensation over the next few months. £15 million worth has been paid out already to 10 relatives. All 16 people on board the Super Puma lost their lives in April 2009 when it crashed off Peterhead. An investigation into the tragedy is still ongoing. An Aberdeen oil tycoon is in line for a £1 billion windfall from a discovery in the North Sea. Ian Sutty's company, First Oil and Gas, has a 30% stake in the Kraken field east of Shetland. It's understood to have around the potential to recover 160 million barrels of oil. It's thought at today's prices, the firm's share of the field would be worth around £3.2 billion. The find could see Mr. Sutty take the title of Scotland's second richest person. Plans have been lodged to connect Scotland's electricity market with mainland Europe for the first time. NorthConnect wants permission to link to the national grid at Peterhead. A 350-mile cable would allow electricity to flow between Scotland and Norway, where work's underway to identify a suitable landing point. A guard ship was sent to keep watch over an unexploded mine in the North Sea last week. Shell say there was a risk that the World War II bomb launched under a pipeline 100 kilometres off St Fergus could explode. If that happened, it would cause significant damage to the pipe, which supplies 5% of the UK's daily gas needs. A Shell spokeswoman insists the bomb is stable. Now, we learned last week that the oil and gas sector could cut a fifth off the cost of setting up offshore wind farms. David Rennie's from Scottish Enterprise.
It's a report we've issued this week, and really has two main purposes. One, to show to the oil and gas supply chain the opportunities that are going to arise in the offshore wind market over the next few decades. And then for the offshore wind developers to highlight the capability that the oil and gas supply chain has in key parts of the offshore wind cycle. The guide really sort of breaks down the offshore wind cycle or project into the various parts, and it shows that in a number of areas such as, you know, design work, fabrication, installation, cabling and so on, that the expertise that's obviously been built up in the oil and gas supply chain, predominantly in the northeast, could reduce costs of offshore wind by about 20%. Now, that's quite important because offshore wind, as with all new emerging technologies, is relatively expensive. And the sort of cost of generating offshore wind, the industry sort of standard price at the moment is around about £140 per megawatt hour. Now, that compares to around about £80 to £90 for onshore wind. Now, there's common agreement that 140 figure needs to come down to certainly around about £100 if possible. So the oil and gas expertise could reduce that £140 by around about 20%. So that's obviously quite a significant saving. We've also been doing a lot of work in Scottish Enterprise in effect bringing the two sectors together, collaboration, and this guide is one part of that. And I think feedback we got from oil and gas supply chain was that many companies didn't necessarily understand what's involved in offshore wind. You know, what are the processes, what are the stages that you need? And of course, if you don't know that, you don't know the question of, well, is there an opportunity in offshore wind for my company? And that's really what this guide is trying to show. A, the savings that oil and gas supply supply chain can provide, but more specifically for individual companies, particularly those lower down the supply chain. It's about saying, well, I'm involved in a particular aspect of oil and gas supply chain. I see that part of that is also required for offshore wind. Therefore, there's an opportunity. And then the guide goes on to provide more information about support and services that are available from Scottish Enterprise and others to sort of, you know, get more information and start to really investigate offshore wind as a future opportunity. The targets that have been put in place are, there's talk about 10 gigawatts of offshore wind going into Scottish waters by 2020. Now, that's equivalent to around about 2,000 turbines, individual separate turbines being installed off Scottish waters. Now, that's quite a challenging target because 2020 isn't that far away. So it's a big market. And I think it's important to stress as well that this is not about saying, you know, this is an alternative to oil and gas. It's not saying that oil and gas, you know, companies will stop oil and gas activity and will move into renewables. It's an additional business opportunity for many companies. And in fact, we already see some companies, that are already operating in both. Companies like Subsea 7 and Technip, for example, have set up their offshore wind divisions in Aberdeen. And that's a sign, I think, of A, confidence in the market, and B, a recognition of the strengths that currently exist in oil and gas in Aberdeen in the northeast, and that crossover potential that's there. So it's already happening, and there's a number of areas of interest of potential inward investors looking to come to Scotland for various parts of offshore wind. But it's also about the infrastructure, and we have something called the National Renewables Infrastructure Fund, which is a cross-Scotland fund, which in effect is saying to ports and harbours, because obviously that's where a lot of the turbines and blades that will be shipped out from. So you need obviously facilities and handling facilities at ports in Scotland. So we've put together a funding package, and we've invited bids from harbours and ports around Scotland in terms of what do you need in order to capitalise on this future opportunity, and we're currently evaluating those bids. But we also have other work. We announced this week a £35 million fund for prototypes for wind turbines. There's additional support through other business support mechanisms, proof of concept and others. And then we're also developing an expert help service, which really is quite detailed work, which goes into companies on a one-to-one basis and says, you know, as a company, this is what you need to do to get ready for the offshore wind sector. And that's been the feedback we've had on that already has been quite positive, actually.
The finalists have been announced for the 2011 Oil and Gas UK Awards. The event, which is sponsored by Shell UK, is going to be held at the Aberdeen Exhibition and Conference Centre on November the 3rd. Tricia O'Reilly from Oil and Gas UK says it promises to be bigger and better than ever.
The quality of the entries this year have been outstanding, and we're constantly taken aback by actually, you know, how each year seems to surpass the previous. Certainly the quality of the entries reflects the high calibre, the highly skilled and talented workforces out there. So of course that makes the competition very, very exciting. Now of course we don't know who the winners are yet, because the shortlisted candidates are still to meet the judges for an informal interview. So the event itself will be quite exciting, because we won't know who will have won until then. We've got five categories. There are three individual awards. So one for overall excellence, which recognises the outstanding achievement by young people working in the UK offshore oil and gas industry. There's the Young Technician of the Year, and that recognises the vital contribution that the industry's young technicians make. And the final individual award is the one for mentoring, which actually recognises the important role that mentors play in passing on their knowledge and expertise to the next generation. And then we also have two awards for corporate performance, and these are for people development, which recognises the outstanding commitment made by an organisation in developing its people, and the second corporate award is for business efficiency, and that recognises innovation in the delivery of improved operational performance. We have a highly skilled, highly talented workforce out there, but it's a workforce where the talent is where the light is often hidden under the bushel. So these awards aim to bring that to the fore. They aim to celebrate the stars.
And North Sea oil and gas platforms have become havens for fish. Scientists from Aberdeen University say the structures are a favourite for many species. And in the future, offshore wind farms could have built-in reefs to attract even more. Dr. Toyonobu Fujii conducted the research.
I looked at spatial and temporal trend of fish distribution in the North Sea in relation to installation history of offshore oil and gas platforms. Originally, I found that the fish such as cod or haddock tend to congregate around this oil platform. And then I got interested in about this sort of fish behavior, and then examined how this fish aggregating behavior can affect the overall fish population distribution in a wider spatial scale in the North Sea. There are a lot of speculations about why they tend to congregate around oil platforms, but the exact mechanism for this phenomena is actually not satisfactorily identified yet. For example, now we know that quite often whenever we look at oil platform, and then we tend to have a higher abundance of fish around oil platforms. So certainly we want to know how they are actually utilizing this kind of artificial structures. And then if they are using, for example, as a nursery ground for juvenile fish, or if they are using as a spawning ground for a big adult fish, and then the implication for this might be substantial in terms of the future fish population dynamics. So this is sort of something I need to find out in the future. Apparently some pelagic fish like mackerel also at some point they tend to congregate these structures as well. And again, the exact mechanism for this reason is not known yet.
And that's the Energy Week podcast. I'm Joe Odber.
Listen again to what you've missed and access exclusive online-only content at northsound1.com/listen-again.